Well, good afternoon, everybody. What I'd like to do today is to share our experience at the Agricultural Sustainability Institute at UC Davis, developing the Food Carbon Footprint Initiative, or a low carbon diet. And before we go any further, I just want to say there's no financial relationships. The goal of our project is to reduce energy intensity and greenhouse gases in the food system, and also to promote actions towards a low carbon diet. And we're using a life cycle assessment approach in our research, sometimes known as LCA, but I don't want the water squirter to come out. But that basically means gathering and analyzing data from farm to fork, all the way through the supply chain. And after our research, we're hoping to share findings broadly with policymakers that are very interested in this information, agricultural professionals, farmers, the food industry, consumers, and now all of you in the public health and nutrition community. Whoops. Who are already promoting solutions to low-carbon diets by your current work in promoting health for all people in an environmentally responsible way. So, for the last few years, and I'm not going to go into this because Danny did such a good job with it, but we have been hearing a lot about climate change in the food system. And since the food system is one of the more important of our human activities because it has to do with daily and long-term survival for all of us, it's an important thing to look at. And it is unquestionably a significant contributor to climate change. A 2006 study from the European Commission found, as Danny said, that the food system's responsible for 30% of global warming generated by the consumer economy in industrialized nations. But the food system also represents a place in which all of us touch every day, and we all have an opportunity to think about ways of reducing the carbon footprint and energy use and greenhouse gases. So, what about these greenhouse gases? What are the impacts in the food system? And I'm going to go through these fairly quickly because you've just heard about them. What the contributions are through the different parts of the supply chain, which is what the life cycle assessment process does. There's agriculture production practices such as fossil fuel use in machinery, fossil fuel-based pesticide and synthetic fertilizer production, and application. Then there's the transport of raw agricultural products from coast to coast, country to country, by many different modalities, ship, airplane, and truck when it's more intercontinental like this. Then there's the processing of food products and maintaining them at retail outlets. This is quite a bit of processed food products, yes, you can see, but most of the greenhouse gases are generated in refrigeration in retail outlets. And then finally, consumption, the storing, going and getting the food, storing, cooking, and then unfortunately the waste at the end of the process. So at the Agricultural Sustainability Institute, as we began to unpack where all these greenhouse gases were occurring throughout the supply chain, we began to realize that there are some complex trade-offs between sectors, such that if you lower your energy use in one area, you might be raising it someplace else. And there's always going to be questions about what's the best choice. For example, there has been this ongoing dilemma that many of us have heard about and many environmentally conscious consumers are concerned about whether they should eat organic or whether they should eat local. What should they put attention to? And the answer, of course, is it depends. And it depends on how things are happening all the way through the supply chain, as we see here in this process map of a supply chain for tomato paste, which is one of the products that we first started looking at with our life cycle assessment. You really have to look at the entire chain and where the greenhouse gases and energy use is occurring. So the next couple of slides, I just want to show you a little bit more in detail about what this LCA is, life cycle assessment. This is from one of my engineering colleagues. And what it is it's a life cycle assessment allows us to describe and quantify the environmental processes, including the embedded materials and the energy inputs that go into the system at every single stage of the process. So we're looking at the embedded materials and energy and also the waste. So we are actually able to measure the material and energy inputs into a system for a particular system that we're evaluating, a food product or kind of food, and then look at the outputs that include things like air pollutants, water, effluents and solid waste, but also greenhouse gases, which is what we're in particularly interested in. Well, it turns out that most of this research on food and life cycle assessment, where we get to quantify these actual greenhouse gases, most of the research has been done in Europe, and there's very little in the United States and very little databases, very few in the United States. So about a year ago, our institute brought together an international symposium with researchers that were doing this cutting-edge research from Switzerland, Denmark, the Netherlands, the UK, to help us design a research framework so that we could begin to look at some of these trade-offs. So the way that we're putting this together is framing the research framework by the particular dilemmas that are faced by consumers and the industry. These issues span the supply chain. They don't just focus on one little slice of the problem. And then we wanted to identify the hot spots in which the existing literature and our research is telling us we need to pay more attention to. So we came up with five key questions that I want to just review with you quickly right now. Now, I'm not saying that we have the answers. We're just beginning to ask the questions, and you'll see how some of these things are a little bit complex. So the first one is, what are the trade-offs between the type of production system and transport distance? So from a consumer's perspective, they might say, is it better for me to buy organic vegetables that have been imported, or should I buy conventionally grown vegetables that are sourced locally? Well, part of the answer to that is it depends on the production system. Now, we all know, we were learning, that organic systems have been shown to have lower greenhouse gases and energy than conventional systems, and it's mostly due to the fertilizer that is used in conventional systems. But then once you find that out, one also has to look at the yields, because that really affects which of those systems is going to be more efficient. And once you do that, then you can look at how far you can transport a particular product before the savings from growing it organically, for example, begin to evaporate. So that's one way of looking at that question. The second one is, how do you compare small-scale local food systems that have short supply chains and direct marketing and small farms with regional food systems that have regional distribution systems and global-scale food production systems? Now, part of the answer to that involves knowing about your transport mode. So you can see here that there are pretty large differences in energy use and greenhouse gases between these different modes of transportation, with ship being the very smallest and air travel being per millijoule ton kilometer being the very most. So you kind of have to know what that is. The third question is, under what conditions and for which commodities are processed foods more energy and greenhouse gas efficient than fresh foods? So a consumer might say, in the winter, is it better for me to buy a local canned tomato than it is for me to cook with fresh tomatoes shipped from overseas, for example? Well, one way we can look at the processing question in this is to consider this example with dried versus fluid milk. This is a Dutch study, I believe. And our first thought when we see this graph is that the dried milk is much more energy intensive because it uses so much more at the processing stage. However, if we add up all the contributions at each stage of the from production to consumption, you can see that fluid milk is actually more energy intensive. So this just underscores the importance of looking across the lifespan of a product so that we can kind of see what's going on at every stage. And I'm skipping this. This is Dutch carrots, but that just shows you the same basic, you have to look at every single stage. I did want to point out this one process of heated greenhouses, which are particularly energy inefficient. And at this one Swedish study shows that tomatoes that were imported from Southern Europe, either fresh or canned, were far more energy efficient than if they had been grown fresh in greenhouses locally. So that is one area to pay attention to. Now the fourth question really follows up on what Danny said about meat. How do different protein products compare to one another, whether it's eggs, poultry, meat, ruminants, fish, whatever? And how do they compare to plant protein? Well, it turns out that meat and dairy, according to this one Dutch study, make up half of all food-related emissions, and the meat is the blue and the maroon right below it's the dairy. So you can see those are both pretty high when you look at the whole food system by food product. And animal-based protein foods are about 2 to 100 times more energy intensive than plant-based foods. If you want to get more specific and look at range-fed versus feedlot, this is another issue that there are a lot of questions still remaining. With concentrated feed, as you might see in feedlots, you actually reduce methane and nitrous oxide production, but increase carbon dioxide, and that probably has to do with the production of the feed. And then the fifth question is, what about at the post-retail stage? How large are consumer-level energy and climate impacts compared to the pre-retail sector of the food system? Well, Kramer again, the Dutch study, shows that consumption accounts for about a quarter of greenhouse gas emissions of the Dutch food supply chain. And this is at least that much in the United States. A lot of it has to do with the kitchen appliances, mostly refrigeration, consumer transportation to the grocery store, and cooking methods. And as you can see here, the very last bar here is the home storage, which is the highest of all the other sectors. So from looking at all these studies and putting together our own research plan, we were able to come up with 6 hot spots, which we think are areas to really focus on in the next years as we pick particular commodities to look across the supply chain at these issues. The first is that livestock-related methane and nitrous oxide emissions are a big one, probably the top of the list. Synthetic nitrogen fertilizers, also a big user of energy and greenhouse gases. Air freight, big sink, heated greenhouse production, big. Post-retail and consumer transport, port and food storage, there's some research on that, but it's just, we feel like that there's a lot more there. And food waste is at multiple points in the supply chain, is an area where there's probably a lot of energy use and greenhouse gases. Now, just before I end, I want to just point out that the whole carbon footprint mentality that we've all gotten, we've all sort of flocked to, is only one part of the whole spectrum of what we're talking about when we say sustainable food system. I mean, carbon is one thing, but so is water quality and water and whether we're going to have any water and equity in the food system and public health, food security, animal welfare, and many other things. So I just don't want us to lose sight of the larger picture in which carbon footprints are one important piece. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Are there any clarifying questions? I don't know about you, but when I go to the grocery store, I certainly don't think about a life cycle assessment. And I think about these issues about, yeah, go ahead with your question. Right, so I'm guessing is that sort of along the lines of, you know, there's kind of a list of, if you're going to choose organic, these are the 10 that should be top on your list, these are the, et cetera. I actually brought some little pamphlets, it's brand new, hot off the press, about GMOs and which are the kind of ingredients or which are the brands that are least likely to have GMOs. Do you guys know of anybody who's doing that, kind of the numerics on the carbon? You're going to be talking about labeling?